Critics of the Affordable Care Act give Congressman Steve Daines an earful. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. We'll also tell you why the estate of a reclusive Montana copper heiress is still in dispute. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with ranch hand and author Bryce Andrews about his new book on the challenges of modern-day ranching in Montana, everything from encroaching development to wolves. Congressman Steve Daines says his office receives hundreds of letters from Montanans about the Affordable Care Act. He says the letters come both in opposition to Obamacare and in support of it. But Daines believes the vast majority of Montanans have concerns with the new law. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about a roundtable discussion giving the congressman a chance to reaffirm those beliefs.
My objective here today is to learn and listen.
Congressman Steve Daines scribbles on a notepad in the conference room of the Montana Chamber of Commerce. The point of this roundtable is to highlight the negative impacts being felt by businesses and individuals due to the Affordable Care Act. Representatives from the Montana Association of Independent Bankers complain of higher insurance rates for mandated changes to policies. Kenny Martin with First Bank of Lincoln.
We can only eat so much of this cost of the regulatory burden.
A sick woman named Margot Wright explains about her planned kidney transplant being delayed as she had to move from her old insurance plan into a new one because of the law.
Just being put on hold and not being able to process to get a kidney is very frustrating.
Wright since has found private insurance that is actually cheaper than what she was paying before, and it will cover the operation, but she says she has to wait for the new coverage to be approved by her transplant center. Several private insurers told Daines they feel Obamacare is trying to legislate them out of existence. Gene Schott is the director of operations for the Montana Contractors Association Health and Retirement Trusts. His nonprofit organization operates an independent, self-funded insurance plan for about 7,000 employees of the Contractors Association's member companies. Schott says his organization is being hit with new fees from Obamacare, and he expects them to total more than $1 million in 2014. These fees largely support the government healthcare programs Medicaid and Medicare, as well as private health insurance companies operating on the Affordable Care Act online exchange that give plans to low-income people. Those companies on the exchange, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana, Pacific Source, and the Montana Health Co-op, they will pay the fees too, but they'll be able to recoup some of that.
But self-funded entities like the MCA Trusts will only pay in. We will not have any right to draft money back out of this for anything. So these are true subsidies of other plans that we're forced to pay into.
The Montana Commissioner of Securities and Insurance regulates the insurance industry in Montana. General counsel for the commissioner, Christina Goh, attended the roundtable to gather information too. She says the discussion does not represent the whole story of the ACA in Montana.
We have many stories from people who are getting coverage for the first time when they were previously denied coverage, or they're getting coverage at a much lower rate.
Those types of stories were not present at the roundtable. Here's Congressman Daines.
We always want to seek a balanced view on that. I can just tell you, though, that the feedback we're receiving, it's far more Montanans are concerned about Obamacare than are supporting it.
Daines says he still wants to pursue full repeal of the Affordable Care Act. He does admit it will be a tough goal, with President Obama in office until 2016. By then, the healthcare and insurance industries will have made big changes to accommodate the law.
Accepting the realities of the political environment back in Washington, but never being willing to give up the fight we need to have for ensuring that we look for improving the affordability and accessibility of healthcare in this country.
I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, a Washington State tire company that purchased the former federal courthouse in downtown Billings has yet to find a tenant for its office and retail space. Colorado Tire Corporation spokesman Katie Feedback says the Tacoma, Washington-based company has hired a manager for the five-story building. The Billings Gazette reports the company began offering free office improvement designs in September to any group that signed a long-term lease. Colorado Tire declined to say if anyone has taken the offer, but Feedback says a number of businesses and organizations have expressed interest. Colorado Tire submitted a $3.275 million bid for the James F. Batten Federal Building on May 12th and completed the purchase on August 1st. Asbestos contamination in the Batten Building led to the construction of a new courthouse. The Institute for Tourism and Recreation Research at the University of Montana says 2013 was a good year for tourism in Montana, and all early signs point to a good 2014. ITRR Director Norma Nickerson says over 11 million non-residents visited Montana last year and spent nearly $3.5 billion. That was despite the October government shutdown, which particularly affected gateway communities around national parks. Nickerson says Montana's tourism-driven businesses seem optimistic about this year's prospects.
We don't know. We have projections. And when we do our Outlook survey, we ask the business leaders around the state in tourism, you know, what is it looking like? And they're very, very, very positive. 57% of the business said, oh, we are going to have a good year in 2014.
More with Nickerson and her look back at last year's steady tourism rates and her projections for this year. That's later this week on Montana Evening Edition. A night nurse for a reclusive Montana copper heiress who lived for 20 years in a New York City hospital isn't happy with a settlement over the woman's nearly $300 million estate. The New York Post reported today that Geraldine Coffey filed court papers last week objecting to the September settlement over Hugot Clark's will. Clark's father was a Montana senator whose wealth came from copper, railroads, and founding Las Vegas. Clark died in 2011 at age 104. Coffey says she was shut out of settlement negotiations. Under the deal, she inherits nothing. However, Coffey got $1 million in gifts during Clark's lifetime. Clark's estate is suing Coffey and others to try to recover such gifts. Clark's estate has said Coffey pressured her patient for gifts. Coffey denies it. Veterans in the state now have the option of getting a special driver's license or state ID card that identifies them as veterans. This after a law passed by the 2013 legislature went into effect at the beginning of the year. Christine Thatcher is the bureau chief for driver licensing at the State Motor Vehicle Division. Thatcher says the new license will allow veterans to avoid carrying around other military identification with them.
The ability to have a veteran designation on the driver's license or identification card will enable veterans to be able to show that credential and be able to receive a customer discount from the businesses that honor those discounts for Montana veterans.
Applicants for the new license must first confirm their status with the State Veterans Affairs Division. A replacement driver's license costs $10 if the old license is not expired. Bryce Andrews grew up in Seattle, but childhood visits to a family friend's ranch in Montana began a love affair with ranching that carried him back to Montana to live and work full-time as a ranch hand. He landed on the sprawling Sun Ranch between Ennis and Yellowstone National Park at the edge of the Lee Metcalf Wilderness. What he learned there, about ranching, about himself, and about wild things like wolves, is the focus of his new book, Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. In this feature interview, Andrews talks with news director Sally Mock about falling in love with ranching at an early age on the Zents Ranch near Billings, and about the beauty and brutality of the profession.
Always just really liked being able to work directly with the land and use my hands to accomplish things that I could really see in the world.
And you learned some skills there that really stood you in good stead when you applied for a job on the Sun Ranch near Yellowstone.
I did, absolutely. I don't think I would have ever gotten the job, ever gotten the chance on the Sun Ranch without what I did on the Zents' place. So I owe them a great debt for taking me through that completely useless initial help that's not help kind of phase.
There's a point in the book where you talk about the job description for the Sun Ranch job, and the qualifications that they wanted were, quote, common sense, adaptability, and gumption.
Yeah, gumption. I still use that now when I put together announcements for ranch hand positions when I'm hiring people. Jeremy,
gumption is definitely called for, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and it's kind of a hard quality to pinpoint, to put your finger on, but you can kind of tell if somebody has it or doesn't. And Jeremy, the guy I worked for on the Sun Ranch, he was the foreman there, I think that putting that on the job description was probably one of the smartest things he ever did, putting that together.
And Jeremy was one of two mentors you had on the ranch. There were Jeremy and James, who, like you, were ranch hands. There, Jeremy was in charge. And Jeremy was an interesting character because you think of ranch foremans, you have this kind of idea of them, but he's somebody who watched Democracy Now.
And yeah.
I think, God forbid, probably listened to public radio.
I sure hope he did. I know he did. You know, Jeremy and James both are interesting characters. And interesting people in the real world. You know, we sort of have this idea of the mythic West and the cowboy out there. And I don't know that that really exists. You know, we're all just sort of individuals trying to make our living in a hard landscape. And I think that draws interesting people, and it causes people to become more interesting and develop strange, wonderful idiosyncrasies while they're out there too.
You said in the book that one of the things you learned is that most of the living things on the ranch are either, quote, with you or against you.
Certainly that's the way it feels sometimes. I think a rancher has to walk a very, very fine and difficult line between feeling that way, that, you know, certain parts of the natural world are your friend and certain parts are your enemy. You have to balance that with the knowledge that the entirety of that system, that functioning natural system, that is what allows you to do your work and make your living. And at the end of the day, all the parts of that working together are what sustains your livelihood.
You love the work.
Yeah.
And you also talk about, quote, I was living at the center of my heart's geography.
That's very true. I've always loved the work. You know, I love some parts of it more than others. And, you know, this is kind of a strange thing maybe, but for example, I've always loved tearing out fences more than I like building them. I did love the work. I really responded to it. And there was something about the ability to touch the natural world, to affect it, to change it, that really clicked with me. And part of that might be because I grew up in art galleries, and the cardinal rule in an art gallery is you don't get to touch anything. And that was always a tough thing for me as a kid, you know, seeing these beautiful things and not being able to really interact with them the way I wanted to.
You also say that ranch work is a mixture of beauty and brutality. And that is so well, I think, described in your book. There are some scenes that are wonderful in their beauty and scenes that are repulsive in the brutality.
Yeah, yeah. It's another one of those fine lines to walk. And it's a tough one because of the two, brutality is certainly the easier one to ape for a person. And I think, you know, in many ways, the greatest test of a rancher or a ranch hand or anybody that makes their living with animals and on the edge of a wilderness, the greatest test is, you know, how well can you walk that line, and to what extent can you choose to yaw a little bit closer to the beautiful side of things and stay away from the magnetism of the destructive, brutal ones.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of contradictions in the life, aren't there, Bryce?
Sure.
One of them is how the ranch hands love the livestock because they see them as something that they're there to protect at all costs. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a scene where there was a recalcitrant cow, number 512,
who
didn't want to go to a pasture.
Right.
And there's a scene where James, the cow is down, and James takes a rope and beats the living daylight out of the cow, and then they drag the cow with the rope, and you think the cow is going to die.
Yeah, that was the first thing I'd ever seen that was really like that, and it was certainly a difficult thing at the time and afterward, but I think a person also has to understand context. And, you know, one of the things that I think was going on in James's head, and certainly would have been in mine if I'd been in his position, is he'd actually seen the horrible results of leaving a cow behind once. He left one behind and it got on a highway. Actually, a guy he was working for did this, got on the highway and a motorist hit it and it killed the motorist. And so these things build up in you and you feel this pressure that's
leaving
more...
Leaving the cow was not an option.
Leaving the cow was not an option for a couple reasons. You know, what I just mentioned, and then also the fact that it was a landscape full of predators, and in some ways leaving her would have been basically offering her up as a sacrifice. To leave her alone and move the rest of the herd on.
The other big theme of the book, of course, is that you're living in wolf country. And as you said, it's on the edge of the Lee Metcalf Wilderness, and there was a pack called the Wedge Pack that Correct. Was living there when you were there. One of the first inklings you have of the kind of regard that local ranchers there have of wolves, you were talking to the matriarch of a local ranching family, and I want to read what you wrote about her, and you said, quote, "When I told her I didn't own a rifle, she stared at me as though I had revealed a deep-seated, appalling vice. Looking down from the saddle, she fixed me with a hard, appraising glare. It got to me. For a moment, I was ashamed to be a man of 23, presenting myself as a ranch hand with just a shotgun to my name. As she watched me think this through, her face softened just a fraction. Tell you what, she said. If you need a gun, you call me."
I mean, I think there's certainly a lot in there, you know, because there's a definite strong stance with regard to wolves, but there's also a certain kind of deeply hidden warmth about the way she responded, too.
She wanted to be helpful, but she also thought you needed a gun if you're going to be around wolves.
Right. And she wanted to be helpful, but she wanted me to make sure I was on what she thought of as the right team. And I think that's one of the things that people may struggle with this book is that, you know, I've always had a difficulty choosing sides in this. I have a deep appreciation and a love for the work and the life of ranching, but I have an equally deep sympathy for wild animals like the wolf. I think that's a good position to write from, but I think it's a difficult one for a lot of people.
And really what happens on the ranch is that as the pasturing changes over the summer, you keep moving the cattle deeper into what is the wolves' territory. And that yeah. is when things really begin to get dramatic.
Right. Although it's not as simple as, you know, pushing a log toward a fire. It's, you know, the wolves were constantly moving through the landscape and the cattle were cycling through too. So there was a sense of inevitability about it. And as the summer matured and the grass was greener higher up, our margin for error grew a lot thinner.
And eventually it broke and the wolves started eating some of the heifers.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really strange to have that happen because for me as a city kid, I did love ranching, but more than anything else, I moved there to be close to the wilderness, to be close to wild animals like the wolf. And so to be put in such violent conflict with them was a really strange thing for me.
And you ended up shooting a wolf. You describe how your attitude changed at some point. At some point, you went from being thrilled about the wolves being there to being angry at the wolves for what they were doing to the livestock that it was your job to protect.
There's a lot of ambivalence there, you know, a lot of inner conflict, I think. And, you know, I found myself sleeping out with the cattle, trying to protect them, sort of running myself down that way, not getting enough sleep. And yeah, it's difficult. You become invested in these creatures, these livestock, because we've bred this race of innocents, you know, big, you know, happy, fat innocents. And we turn them out in some of the wildest country in the world, country with teeth. And then it's very difficult to not feel like you owe them some level of protection. And that's a really hard thing to balance with your desire not to kill a creature that you really respect. So mm-hmm. This is a very hard thing for me.
You write about the aftermath of killing the wolf.
Sure.
And at some point, you and James and Jeremy are hauling the wolf out of where you killed it.
Yeah.
You say, quote, in the book, "I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that I had taken something that floated through the forest like a spirit and reduced it to dead weight and a fecal smell."
Yeah, that was a really difficult thing to square with. I had a friend ask me later, you know, how do you get over something like that? How do you get over, you know, crossing a line that you didn't think you would cross? And I don't really have a good answer for that. I mean, I think, you know, maybe the best way to sum it up is that, you know, time passes and you do other things, but at the same time, you know, I won't forget what I did, and the reasons for it have always been kind of complicated for me. It's one thing to say, yeah, it was my job, and I had to do it because I had to protect these cattle. But I think that doesn't cover the entire situation.
You go on in the book to talk about the changing landscape in terms of the future of ranching and the future of wolves, because eventually this pack was killed, the whole pack,
sure,
because of the conflict with cattle. And then you write about how the owner of the ranch, a wealthy man, but still having trouble keeping the ranch going and having it be self-sustaining. And so at some point he thinks about selling a few parcels to some millionaires as a way to keep the ranch viable, the rest of the ranch viable. And that is a conflict that's playing out in many, many parts of Montana.
And that's where I think we get into something really, really interesting, because you know, we've been fighting this wolf thing for a while, you know, kind of tearing each other's throats out over the thing. And I guess I would contend that, you know, no matter what happens on a ranch like the Sun, with cattle and wolves, you know, I think we're better off if that place stays open, which is to say, you know, we will lose cattle and we will lose wolves, and that will keep happening. But if we can continue to try every year to do it better, I think there's real hope and real potential. And I think if a landscape becomes developed, if it becomes fragmented, I think that hope for the future winks out pretty much instantly. Because
for the cattle and the wolves.
For the cattle and the wolves, yeah. And the people that have made their living there in a sustainable way, or what we hope is a sustainable way. So I honestly believe that we need to have a working landscape, and some level of conflict, some level of bloodshed between cattle and wolves may be inevitable, but I think it's a whole lot better than losing the whole landscape to fragmentation.
Here's what you wrote about that, quote, "The interests of cows, wolves, and elk would collide with the desires of millionaires. When they did, our stewardship of the land would suffer. I felt my job, life, and purpose on the ranch sliding into obsolescence."
Mm-hmm.
"And so I decided to leave." And you did leave.
I did. And I guess I'd want to, you know, say one other thing about the way Roger, the guy that owned the place, approached it. You know, I think he very reluctantly looked at that as an idea.
And felt he had no choice.
Yeah, and I don't mean to set it up as, you know, ranchers and conservationists against, you know, millionaire recreation buyers, because it's not that way. It's, you know, collectively we have to stitch together a landscape that works. And the only thing I know for sure is if you put too many houses in it, it quits working.
Bryce, this is one of the best things I've read about the complexity of the conflict Montanans feel about wolves since they've been reintroduced. So I much enjoyed the book, and I've been speaking with Bryce Andrews, who's the author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. Bryce, just a wonderful read, and I wish you best of luck with the book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Author Bryce Andrews will be featured at a publication party and signing of his new book tomorrow evening from 6 to 8 at the Top Hat in Missoula. Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 8 to 15 degrees. Tomorrow, look for cloudy skies with a slight chance of snow and highs in the upper 20s to mid 30s. In central Montana tonight, expect increasing cloud cover with lows 10 to 25 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with highs in the 30s. In southwest Montana tonight, watch for increasing cloud cover and lows 5 to 20 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow and highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
With the global financial crisis of 2007 hopefully behind us, it is time to look at the future and what opportunities lay ahead for the forest products industry. The world is increasingly becoming a single market with interdependent production systems, consumption of similar goods, and consumers responding to similar conditions. We no longer compete only in a local economy. Advancements in technology have definitely brought us to this juncture. The director of engineering at Google says the law of accelerating returns suggests that an analysis of the history of technology shows that technological change is exponential, contrary to the common sense linear view. We will not experience 100 years of progress in the 21st century. It will seem more like 20,000 years of progress at today's rate. In other words, technology is moving faster than we can grasp. Technological advancement and shifting demographic patterns will fundamentally shape our economic outlook. According to recent reports, the global economy is growing as a result in exploding populations in areas outside of the United States. According to experts, the global population will increase to 8.3 billion by 2030. 60% of the world's population will live in urban areas. There will be 17% increase in urbanization in the United States. And the middle class will see 172% growth in developing countries. A Global Trends 2030 report states, owing to rapid urbanization in the developing world, the volume of urban construction for housing, office space, and transport services over the next 40 years could roughly equal the entire volume of such construction to date in world history. What does this mean for the forest products industry? In addition to harvesting saw logs for traditional and essential commodity products, the exploding growth in the world economy likely means a greater emphasis on certified wood, an increased interest in cellulosic bioenergy, and new uses for wood fiber. Where is the supply to meet the demand going to come from? Currently, there are roughly 400 million acres of timberland across all ownerships in the United States in need of restoration. Typically, restoration means removing excess forest biomass. Without market outlets for this excess, materials often accumulate until a wildfire event. Retaining and sustaining primary and secondary wood manufacturing, pulp and paper production, and creating high-value, market-based outlets for excess forest biomass is vital to the success of accelerated forest restoration and meeting the emerging global demands for wood-based products. In the late 1990s, the Government Accountability Office concluded that the most extensive and serious problem related to the health of forests in the interior West is the overaccumulation of vegetation, which has caused an increasing number of large, intense, uncontrollable, and catastrophically destructive wildfires. This report prompted the development of the National Fire Plan in 2001, which suggested that $850 million annually would be required to address this problem. More recently, the GAO concluded that $69 billion is required over the next 16 years, or $4.3 billion per year. Relying on taxpayer dollars, the U.S. Forest Service has managed an average of only $300 million annually for hazardous fuel treatments. This current model simply will not restore forests, let alone meet global demands. Congress is not likely to cut a $69 billion check without some assurances that harvest levels are sustainable and treatments are ecologically and economically viable. Traditionally, well-managed forests in the United States have been able to earn the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, the Forest Stewardship Council, or the American Tree Farm Seal of Approval, demonstrating that harvest levels are sustainable, that biodiversity and old growth are conserved, and water quality and wildlife habitats are protected. Meeting the global demand for solid wood products and finding high-value, high-volume uses for low-value forest biomass is one of the most important challenges facing policymakers and the forest products industry today. There is little doubt that technological advancements and shifting demographic patterns will fundamentally shape our economic outlook and will shift environmental, economic, and social conditions that will play out over the next few decades. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.